You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good morning. Lovely to see you. Do come a bit nearer if you want to. I feel like there's not going to be like a mosh pit or anything in the middle, so we don't need to keep the space. But thank you so much for coming. I'm Rob Hopkins. I'm one of the founders of the transition movement. And as was said, I'm going to be talking about a book that I wrote called How to Fall in Love with the Future. So this is a session about why we need to do that. And I guess to set the context in which I do the work that I do is the climate and ecological emergency that we are now facing in the world. And the thing about climate science is it's complex, but it's not complicated. There's a very important difference between those two things. And there's an organization called Climate Science Basics who make that very straightforward by splitting it into five key points. So number one, it's warming. We can see that trend happening, not here last night at Hot House, at Greenbelt, I have to say. But generally, around the world, we are seeing a warming trend. Last week, Spain recorded its hottest ever temperature. There were huge wildfires happening across Europe. This is a trend happening. We can see it. But the reality is that we may well look back on this summer as having been the coolest summer of this decade, of this century, unless we really do something about it. So the warming is happening. It used to be, even in this country, if we knew there was heat wave coming, we all dashed out and pulled out the paddling pools and got the barbecue gleamed up and ready for it. Now we think, oh God, this is not going to be great. Number two, it's us. We know what's driving this. It's not a natural cycle. It's not a hoax. It's us. It's our addiction to burning things, whether it's fossil fuels or forest. Number three, we're sure. There's no doubt anymore among people who actually know what they're talking about that it's human activity that is driving this. Number four, it's bad and it will get an awful lot worse. And number five is we can still do something about this. We are not passive in the face of this as it unfolds. But we need to be a hell of a lot more ambitious than we are being about it right now. So when I was writing the book, How to Fall in Love with the Future, I interviewed Peter Kalmus. Some of you may have heard of him. Amazing climate scientist, lives in the US. He used to live in LA. He could see what was happening with the science to the extent that he moved his family out of LA and up to Colorado or somewhere. And then a year after he moved, he sat in where he lived now and watched on TV as the house he had lived in before burnt down in the huge fires that happened there a few months ago. But he's also one of those climate scientists who realizes that it's not okay just being a scientist anymore, publishing papers. He's also been arrested twice, gluing himself to Chase Bank, who still fund oil and gas exploration, and also blocking a private jet airport in the US. So I said to him, as a climate scientist, your job is to set out what are the scenarios that we're heading towards? What are the worst case scenarios? But what's the best case scenario? What's the scenario if we threw everything we possibly could at this? Because we don't talk about that quite so much. What would happen if we did absolutely everything we possibly could have done? And where would that take us? He said, I call that emergency mode. The world goes into emergency mode, which means the rapid phase out of fossil fuels, the rapid phase out of meat. Then we could stay below 2 degrees and then use the different natural things we know can draw down CO2. And I said, that's great, Peter, but emergency mode is a terrible name for it. No one's going to go, yeah, let's do emergency mode. That's great. So this session now is really about what if we do emergency mode, but we call it something else? What if we call it delicious opportunity mode, thrilling adventure mode, ride of our lives mode? Because how we talk about it is really, really important in terms of how we do that as a culture. Because the question that I want you to go away with after this talk is, what does our activism around climate, around social justice, around all these different things that we're all working so hard on, what does it look like if, rather than just talking, imagining that if we give people enough information, they're going to act? If we talk about collapse, we talk about extinction, that's going to mobilize people to act. That doesn't work. We can see that now. It doesn't work at scale. So the question that I want to bring to that is, what does it look like instead if we see the main purpose of our activism as being the cultivation of longing? of deep, deep longing for a different world. If we can bring that alive for people, the way I like to talk about that is by talking about the moon. So in 1865, Jules Verne wrote a book called From the Earth to the Moon. Some of you may have read it. And in that book, he drew together at the time all the best science and engineering about how you might actually get a human being onto the moon. Some of it turned out to be incredibly historically prescient. In his book, his rocket was made of aluminium. It had three astronauts. It took off in Florida. Loads of people came to see the launch. Some of it not quite so accurate. In his book, the rocket was fired out of a huge cannon. We know if you actually did that, as soon as you press the button, basically your astronauts would be turned into jam the moment you press the button. But what that book did with its thrilling story that ran through it was it inspired a whole generation of scientists and engineers to start figuring out how we're going to do that. What might that look like? How could we do that? And more importantly, it also inspired a whole generation of storytellers to tell that story in different ways. The first feature film made in 1902, Georges Méliès, A Trip to the Moon, was about that. You then had this whole genre of popular science, comics and magazines. How will we play football on the moon? What will the hotel be like on the moon? What will we have for dinner on the moon? All this sort of stuff. You had jazz dances about walking on the moon. Mickey Mouse went to the moon. Popeye went to the moon. Tintin, of course, very famously went to the moon. In the 1950s, there was a whole genre of truly dreadful films. There were 10 of them, where basically the same story was that an all-male crew of astronauts went to the moon to find it populated entirely by women who hadn't seen men for a very, very long time. Very strange male fantasy that was playing out. One of those films was called Catwomen of the Moon. And it said on the poster, you've never seen anything like it, which is true. I watched it so that you don't have to. Truly, truly dreadful. But the point is that by the time JFK announced we will go to the moon, not because it's easy, but because it's hard, we'd already been there thousands and thousands of times. The longing came first. We built the longing through storytelling, through music, through film, through all those tools that we have for cultivating longing. And in 1969, when Neil Armstrong actually set foot on the moon, Hergé, who does the Tintin cartoons, did a comic panel that went in the New York Times that showed Neil Armstrong stepping out on the moon to be greeted by Tintin, Captain Haddock, and Professor Calculus, and Snowy the dog, with a little sign saying, "Welcome to the moon, Mr. Armstrong." So the storytelling came first. The creation of longing came first. We don't have 100 years to cultivate the longing for the climate emergency. But for me, the same thing applies. If we're out in the world, particularly at a time when the far right are doing a great job of telling everybody how terrifying the future is going to be and positioning themselves as strong men who'll protect us from that, if at the same time the people who actually understand climate science, more progressive people, are also just painting terrifying visions of the future, people get stuck like a rabbit between two headlights. So for me, this is really going to be a conversation about longing and the importance of that. So I travelled up yesterday from Totnes. Anybody been to Totnes? Very good. So you may know lots of things about Totnes. It's where the first transition town started, first vegetable box scheme in the country. Our resident poet laureate Matt Harvey says that when you've lived in Totnes for a certain amount of time, your body starts to secrete a new hormone called Totnesterone. Where your masculine and feminine come into perfect balance with each other. And famously twinned with Narnia, of course. And but what you don't know about Totnes is that we are the first place in the world to have successfully built an actual time machine.
Ooh, ooh.
Well, thank you very much. If Totnes doesn't win the Nobel Prize for Science this year, I'm going to be really, really put out. And so we've built this machine, not because we want to go off and visit the dinosaurs or go and see Jimi Hendrix playing or anything like that. We've built it because we want to travel to the very near future. Because at the moment in the world, the best thing that we have as a vehicle for addressing the climate emergency is the Paris Agreement, right? The Paris Agreement sets out a pathway to get to zero by 2050. In order to do that, it means that by 2030, we need to have got to cut emissions by about 48%, right? That's not very far away. But if we miss that target, we can kiss goodbye to everything else. So what we do, and there are many different futures, this is the really important thing to say, the future is not just one single fixed thing. The future is not fixed. There are many, many different futures ahead of us. And in this time machine we've built, we visit lots of those different futures. A lot of them are horrible. Believe me, we really don't want to go there. But there are some on the outer edges of possibility, the ones that resulted from us doing everything we possibly could have done, that are really, truly extraordinary. And that's what I want to share with you today, is the trips that we have taken there. And I've actually brought my time machine, which I'm going to show you in a minute. We are going to attempt, my friends, the first act of actual time travel in the history of Greenbelt Festival. And you were here. You'll be able to tell your grandchildren about this. But in order to do that, I need you, if possible. First thing is, if you see me do this, this is how I keep order in these things. If you see me put my hand in the air, you put your hand in the air too and stop talking. And then this will work absolutely beautifully. Could you make a pair with somebody, ideally, that you didn't know before you came here? Take a minute and find somebody. Thank you. Does anybody not have a partner? Very good. We have perfect even numbers in here. Beautiful. Wonderful. Okay. So you might wonder why I'm putting you in a pair with someone you didn't know. Well, we just recently had COVID and we spent a year and a half in our house not seeing anybody. Sociologists tell us we live in an epidemic of loneliness. So even if this turns out to be the worst talk you've been to at all of Greenbelt, you will know one person you didn't know before you came. And I think that's really, really important. And I've done this in my talks now for about 10 years. And so far, I've had five people come up to me and say, couples come up to me and say, you know that thing you did at the beginning of your talks? And one baby. So be careful. So I have bought my time machine. This is a serious bit of quantum. Yeah. Ooh, are you ready? You can feel it already, right? Yeah, the quantum thing starting to shimmer a little bit. Fantastic. Okay. So the other thing I need to teach you is is the sound that a time machine makes. This is very, very important, okay? So this sounds like this, but with you all joining in. Greenbelt Festival, I think we can do it. We're trying to break the fabric of time here. One more time, please. Beautiful, thank you. Okay, so I'm gonna ask if you might close your eyes, please. And feel the ground underneath you. And in a moment, we're going to turn on this time machine and we're going to travel forwards just 5 years to 2030. But those 5 years were the most exhilarating time to be alive. Change happened so fast, it built in cascades. And the world that you're going to step out into is now radically lower carbon, not the finished article, but well, well on the way. And I'm going to ask you if you might take a walk around there in your imagination using all of your senses. What does it smell like? What does it feel like? What does it sound like? What do you see as you walk around? Okay, this future that you most long to see. So I'm going to just set the controls here for 2030. And then we'll set off. So if you keep your eyes closed and turn to your partner, and we'll just take a couple of minutes to share with them. What did you see? What did you feel? What did you hear? How was that? 111. Okay. Okay. Can I call you back again? Thank you. I would do the hand in the air thing, but you've got your eyes closed. I've never quite figured out how to do that bit properly. It would be really lovely to hear, is there anybody who has any little impressions you'd like to share? Anything that surprised you? Anything that delighted you? How was that? It was quieter. It was quieter, thank you. You both independently talked about transport? Okay. A common denominator. Thank you very much. Yes. More trees growing, more vegetables growing where we used to park our cars. Thank you. Outside. Children playing outside. Thank you. I didn't have to run out into. She didn't have to shut her gate anymore because there was no traffic for her child to run into. Yes. You'd switch on the news and there'd be some good news. Doesn't feel like too much to ask for, does it? Something had worked. Beautiful. Thank you. Yes. A lot more insects. Thank you. Yes. Nature would be louder. Yes. We're all talking to each other. We could smell and feel fresh rain, see the blossom. Beautiful. Maybe one more over here. Yes. The buzz of citizens' assembly is beautiful. And very, very back there. Drinking water separate from wastewater. Yes. Thank you. Well, thank you all for doing that. This is an activity that I've done now with tens of thousands of people, I think, in different places, from 10 people in a workshop to, I did this once with 1,500 people in a hall in Belgium. It feels really important to me that we do this, and that this should become a daily practice, like yoga, like meditation, like running, because the reality is that doing the opposite of this is a daily practice for all of us. We wake up, we turn on our phones say, oh God, really? I'd go back to bed if I were you. Things aren't looking great. And we just get kind of paralyzed in that. There's an amazing woman called Elise Boulding, some of you may have heard of. She was the woman who developed peace studies as a kind of an academic discipline in the United States. She did this same, very similar exercise in prisons in the early 1990s and wrote about what people told her, almost exactly the same as what you have fed back to me now. And her hypothesis was that if you did this at any point back during human history, you would hear very, very similar things. And her conclusion was, I think we have many more allies for the work ahead than we might imagine we do. Like I say, I've done this with tens of thousands of people. Nobody ever says, we've got a new IKEA, Rob. It's 4 times bigger than the one we used to have. Or my iPhone 27 can give me tattoos. Somehow there's something about this activity that connects you into a future which is the one which is based on contentment and community and happiness, and not the one driven by dopamine and pleasure that is the one that we read about all the time. So what I want to do is to tell you a little bit about a recent trip that I took to 2030. You might like to think of me as being a bit like sort of Marco Polo or kind of Phineas Fogg of the climate movement, reporting back on a recent trip that we took. And the first impression that we always have when we arrive into that 2030, firstly, is how amazing the air smells. It smells like spring in the mountains. It's clean, it's fresh. If you had a sommelier's nose, you'd be able to pick out different things like herbs, plants that are growing, food being prepared. You know, that it smells so different to what we left behind. Secondly, as somebody said, the bird song is so much louder. In fact, now when we walk through the city, the bird song is louder than the traffic. And in certain parts of the city where different birds have come back, like nightingales, people do actually now go to hear the nightingale sing in Berkeley Square, often at the end of a night out, and often musicians will go along and accompany them as well. The most important thing that I think that we notice when we arrive there is the look in people's eyes. So as time travelers, part of our time travel training, in fact, I should tell you this because there are 5 very important rules for time traveler that we learn in time traveler school. So number 1 is no bringing any books back. That's cheating. People have to figure this stuff out on their own. Number 2, avoid the silly stuff, you know, killing your grandparents or falling in love with your mother. That kind of thing. It creates a mess that's very hard to unpick. Number 3, no past splaining. As sociologist Ruha Benjamin puts it, we need to give the voice of the cynical, skeptical grouch that patrols the borders of our imagination a rest. Number 4, make sure your batteries are fully charged before setting off. You don't want to go all that way only for your recording devices not to work. And number 5, never time travel for personal gain. Intention and motivation are all important. Travel for curiosity and for the well-being of others. And so when we arrive there, we have to wear our time travel costume. Some of you might have seen photographs of me wearing that. It has a very special anti-cynicism coating that stops any of that leaking out into that world. Because in this world, people are on it. It's happening. There's this sense of, I think we might just do this, you know. And people can see mental health improving. They can see, as you said, the insects coming back. They can see that stuff changing around them. And you don't want to be the person who rocks up and says, yeah, right, like this is going to work, because it is working. That's the really important thing. And when we were there, one of the things in the cities is there's a whole other world sort of goes on the rooftops, rooftop farms, rooftop gardens. There's so much happening on the rooftops that now municipalities are building routeways to connect them together so you can cycle around above the city and visit all these amazing things. And I was a little bit, I want to read you a paragraph from the book, where when we were there up on the rooftop, we met 2 young women up there who were reflecting on what that change was like to live through. And one of them was called Sally. And she said, I'm always struck, Sally tells us, when I rewatch old TV shows, how being cynical was normal and cool. It wasted so much energy. But a movement began to grow that saw cynicism as undesirable, something that robbed us of energy and possibilities. I look back and I'm so glad those days of cynicism are behind us. I feel like we were part of the generation that had to decide we can be cynical or we can try to solve problems. So we became the generation that realized our future depended on each other, and that became our guiding star. So we also, one of the most wonderful things that I can report back to you from that future is the bicycle rush hours of 2030. One of the most incredible things, every morning, every evening, this river of bicycles, because we built the infrastructure. We realized back in 2025, if any of you can remember back to 2025, that actually every £1 million we spent building good cycling infrastructure saved us £38 million off the National Health Bill. We started to think like that. This stuff wasn't an expense. It was an investment into well-being. And now all those underground car parks, you remember underground car parks, we don't need them anymore because there's so many fewer cars. Those spaces have all been repurposed as clean, free places for people to leave their bicycles, and people use it. Every train station you walk out of now, you just see lots and lots of bicycles. And one of the things that really we noticed was how much softer the cities feel because of the depaving movement that started in 2025. We realized in that hot summer of 2025, when cities get above 29, 30 degrees, concrete and tarmac in cities is dangerous stuff. It holds so much heat and keeps those cities from cooling down. So the depaving movement grew and grew. And now we see, now in London, for example, it has about 40% of those hard surfaces have been removed, replaced with plantings. It's just a beautiful thing. But it was led by people. There was a movement that started in the Netherlands in 2024 called Tegelwippen, which means tile flipping, which was basically different neighborhoods challenging each other to see who could remove the most hard surfaces, and then they would get prizes. That just swept around the world. Beautiful, beautiful thing to see. We went to visit whole neighborhoods that have been redesigned so there's no space for cars. When you go to visit a neighborhood where there's no cars, it sounds so different. We went there to make recordings, and I'll explain why we need those in a minute. But we went there to make those recordings. I thought, well, I know what it'll sound like. It'll sound like children playing and bicycles. What you don't notice, what I didn't expect to notice, was things like you could hear people having piano lessons in their houses and having meals in their houses, because you don't have that background hum of the internal combustion engine. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing to see. Of course, one of the things that I loved the most in 2030 was the return of the beavers. That after the government re-licensed beavers in 2025, we don't see so much flooding in that 2030, because all those upland areas that we used to, the floodwaters used to come from, we've handed them back to beavers. They trap huge amounts of water and silt, and the biodiversity explodes. I love beavers. They are incredible. We have a government who is in 2025, who has just invented £10 billion in carbon capture and storage, which will capture almost zero CO2. And beavers just get on with it and trap huge amounts of CO2, and have created more new reservoirs in this country than all the privatized water companies have since 1989. And they just get on with it, and they're amazing. We see a lot of urban agriculture, just places in cities used usually for nothing, turned into farms, feeding people. We went to visit this amazing town where 100% of the school meals are organic, and 80% of it is grown in the town. And what they found after they did this, a few years after, was when they surveyed the people in the town, they found that people who would just nothing to do with that project eat 30% ultra-processed food, 23% less meat. Because the culture started to change. We found that when institutions move with boldness and purpose, it starts to ripple out and have much, much bigger impacts. People told me about the hangovers they still have from the day that the parties that celebrated the collapse of BP in 2027. Not a day too soon. And as somebody over here said, we now use citizens' assemblies much, much more. Democracy is now something that's part of our everyday life rather than something that we do than we do every four or five years. Every city now has what's called a civic imagination office. It's recognised we need to build the imaginative capacity in society. Schools are now democratic. Kids have the power to change school rules, but they have to learn first how to practice democracy. It starts as a young age. We eat about 80% less less meat. But the amazing thing was nobody even noticed that shift happening. It just sort of happened around us. And what's beautiful is that most people's lives in this future are so much better than they were before. There are much less billionaires, because what happened was that the billionaires spent trillions of dollars building AI with this promise that it was going to teach us how to tackle climate change. And in 2027, they did that. They pressed a button and it said, you need to get rid of all the billionaires. And they were most disappointed. The royal family and the church across the country used all their land to unlock a huge program of sustainable food production and rewilding. That really gathered pace. It was amazing. And one of the things that we did from in 2030 was we went to visit the free and independent state of Palestine, which is now starting a rebuilding process, which was very beautiful to see as well. And the UK is also now the country in the world which is the most welcoming place for displaced people. Was a deep cultural shift that happened as well. And also, so I'm just going to bring us back to 2025 for a moment and say that most of those things that I've told you about from our trip to 2030 already exist. As William Gibson, apart from the Palestine bit and a couple of the other bits, but most of those things already exist. You can go and see them. You can go and see the bicycle rush hour in Utrecht. You can visit the car-free neighbourhoods in Freiburg in Germany. You can go and visit the town in France where they produce most of the school dinners. We are not waiting for some amazing new invention. Everything we need to know already exists. One of the key things we're lacking is the longing in our culture, the stories about how we might actually do that, how we might get there. And I read the other day, One of the great inspirations for me is an amazing movement which is called Afrofuturism, which some of you may have heard of, which is a beautiful movement which is which comes out of a lot of black culture, which is about talking about the future in different ways. And Gabriel Teodros, who's an amazing poet and teacher and hip-hop artist who I interviewed recently, he said, a thing that's always kept me writing is knowing that if we don't write our own stories down, we get written out of the pages of history. I realize now that if we don't write ourselves into the future, we get written out of tomorrow as well. We're living in a time where the future is being colonized and the future is being cancelled. And I think that's profoundly dangerous. And how we talk about the future is really important. So what I want to do in a second is to talk a little bit about what our activism looked like from 2025 onwards that created that. But firstly, I want to do another little exercise with you where you will need your partner again. So just check they're there and they haven't wandered off. And if you've arrived since then, if you'd like to make a pair with somebody, you'll enjoy this next little bit. Okay, so this is an exercise that goes in three rounds, all right? And you're going to need to look for my hand going in the air, or this bit is just mayhem. So in each round, with your partner, you're taking it in turns to make suggestions for a picnic that you're planning together, all right? So one of you might say, in this first round, one of you might say, I'll bring some sandwiches. And then the other person responds, and then you change over. So it's like suggestions tennis, if you like, in that kind of a way, right? So in this first round, the role of the second person is just to drown the first person's suggestion in as much negativity as you possibly can. All right? So you might say, I'll bring some sandwiches. And the second person could say, the last time I ate your sandwiches, I was in hospital for 6 months, and I swore I would never again eat your pestilent, abominable sandwiches. And then you change over, okay? Does that make sense? Look out for my hand. Off you go. Beautiful. Thank you. Okay, second round. Same idea. You're going to take it in turns to make suggestions. This time, the role of the second person is to accept that person's idea and that invitation, but just with absolutely no enthusiasm at all. Right? I'll bring a cake. Well, if you must. Like that. Off you go. I imagine that those of you here who have been involved in some way in activism or trying to make change, those first two probably feel really familiar. This last one we're going to do is the yes and one, okay? So this time, you're going to accept the other person's invitation and add to it. And just see where it goes. Allow yourselves to go somewhere ridiculous. So I'll bring some champagne. Yes, yes, yes. We could open a champagne bar there down by the water. Yes, yes. We could invite Elton John to come and play the piano. Yes, yes. And we could build a rocket and put him in the rocket and wherever it goes. Just see where it goes. Be bold, be ridiculous. Off you go. Sorry, I always hate having to break that up. It's so beautiful to be up here watching that. People are like this and waving their arms about. How did that one feel different from the first two? Fun? More energizing? Exciting? You could feel yourself smiling. Limitless. But it also, yes, more eye contact. So for me, one of the things that we started doing differently in 2025 that meant we created that world that we've just traveled to is that we started to build our activism around a yes and culture. How do we create that feeling we've just flooded the tent with in our movements, in our organizations, in the way that we talk about the future? And in How to Fall in Love with the Future, what I do is I pull together a whole bunch of different activists around the world doing things which I think really embody that. And so I just want to tell you a few stories about that. And for me, it started when I saw a photo of a young woman at a Black Lives Matter protest in Washington in 2020. And her t-shirt said, "I've been to the future. We won." It gave me such goosebumps. And it made me think, how different would our activism be if instead of just talking about extinction and collapse, we gave people an experience of that? I was then invited up to London to speak at the big one, the Extinction Rebellion thing. And I gave this talk as if I've just parked my time machine around the corner. I've just come back from 2030. Oh my God, it's amazing. I need to tell you all about it. And I did that very similar to what I've just done with you. And there was a moment when I looked at the people closest to me and there were tears on people's faces. And I thought, this is really interesting. What happens here? And the book is really an exploration of that. So a few things that I've seen that for me embody that way of doing activism. Many of you will have been in London in April 2019, the first big Extinction Rebellion. One of the things that happened there was the occupying of Waterloo Bridge. And for 8 days, they turned that bridge into a forest, filled it with trees, 49 mature trees. I've met 5 people. I always show that picture in my talk. I say, this is a pop-up tomorrow. We need to get much better at creating pop-up tomorrows where we bring that future that you imagined before into the present so people could touch it and interact with it. I've met 5 people who worked near Waterloo Bridge, who came there during that and had the experience of stopping on that bridge and going, oh, why can't it always be like this? The creation of pop-up tomorrows is so important. And in dystopian stories like The Handmaid's Tale, they do that so beautifully. They take places we know, like the Washington, the Lincoln Memorial, and they create dystopian versions of it. Let's create positive versions of it. There's an organization a couple of years ago who rewilded Trafalgar Square for a day, that kind of thing. Walida Imarisha, who's an amazing a speculative storyteller in the kind of Afrofuturist tradition in America, she says all organizing is science fiction. All organizing is science fiction. You know, we need to recognize the ability to become much better storytellers. And within that community, there's some amazing people doing work that I would love you to go away and look up. One is 2 women in Philadelphia who do a project called Black Quantum Futurism, which is this amazing project about playing with time, about seeing linear time as a construct created by colonizing powers that trashed indigenous understandings of time and imposed a different understanding on top of that. And they do amazing work around time. There's a woman called Camille Turner in Canada who does a project called Afronautic Research Labs. We all know the history of the slave trade in the United States. Canada tells a different story about itself, that they were the nice people. They were the safe place people could escape to. Wasn't quite like that. Very active slave trade on the east coast of Canada. So she's gone through the archives. She's found all these things like adverts for slave auctions and inventories of slave ships. She has all this laminated in a room for people to come in and read. The bit that is extraordinary and gives me goosebumps is the role of the Afronauts. So when you go into that room to read that material, there's always 2 people of color standing in the corner wearing very ceremonial robes. And the story is that so important is this moment of understanding what happened that they have traveled back from the future to bear witness to this moment. They don't speak. They just stand and observe. And I love this idea that we become more playful with time in our activism. So much of our activism gets stuck in the present. When do we want it? Now, no one ever says. When do we want it? In about 217 years or 5 weeks ago. It's always now. How does it look if we start to play around with that? One of my great inspirations is the great jazz artist Sun Ra. Any Sun Ra fans in today? Ooh, one half-hearted, ooh, over there. Anyway, Sun Ra was this amazing jazz musician who told a story about himself where he said, I'm not actually a human being, I'm actually an angel from Saturn. And Sun Ra once said, the future is obvious, but the potential impossible is calling softly and knocking gently, which I think is just beautiful. And I wrote an article, which you can find online, called What the Climate Movement Can Learn from Sun Ra, or something. And somebody sent me a comment that said they booked Sun Ra's band to come and play in a theatre in Wales. And that when the band sent their rider, you know, bands have a rider, we want Jack Daniels and Blue M&Ms or something backstage. The one for Sun Ra's band said, you have to keep the 6 car parking spaces in front of the venue free so that his spaceship has somewhere to land. That's class. That's class. And Sun Ra died in 1993, but his band, The Orchestra, still play in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is a city with high levels of poverty, particularly among communities of colour there in the city. And there's very low tree cover in those neighbourhoods. There's a campaign, an organisation called Street Work, who are trying to get trees back into those neighbourhoods. And they did an event where they invited Sun Ra's orchestra to play. And they called it Summoning the Future Forest. Summoning the future forest. Not, hey, we should plant some trees, or we need to reach this target of trees. It's like, the future forest is just over there. What we need to do is create the invitational, the magical, the events that summon it to come. In your activism, what might you summon and how might you summon it? I did a talk a while ago online, and I was talking about time travel, time machines, as I often do. And there was a guy there who was a head teacher from a school on Cortes Island in British Columbia. He wrote to me a year later. He said, Rob, after that conversation, we redesigned the whole curriculum in our school for the eldest year of kids. They spent the whole year in 2040. We didn't talk about what 2040 could be like. They spent the year there, and they designed the food, the art, everything that happened there. And at the end of the year, they invited all the people in the town to come to an event. They hired the biggest venue they could find. They built a time tunnel you had to walk through when you came in. And then there was art from the future. There were leaflets from the organizations that didn't exist in 2025, but turned out to have been vital to making that transition happen, like the Ministry for Public Beauty, that was founded in 2026. He said it was a profound effect on the kids, so much different than doing it another way. Also, in Wales, the Banw Brecheniog National Park, what was the Brecon Beacons National Park, they wrote an amazing document that was about their vision for the future, full of like stories from the future, postcards from the future. I gave a talk in Wales. The two women who wrote that were there. 3 months later, they wrote to me and said, Rob, we've built a time machine. Like, what do you mean? They said, well, we got back to the office and we were so filled with this idea that we needed to build a time machine. We found that actually the municipality had bought a mobile planetarium 5 years ago. I think there was grants for buying mobile planetariums. They never quite figured out what to do with it. So they turned it into a time machine, and they now use it to show videos from the past, the present. They get kids to make videos from the future. They've become passionate advocates to local authorities across the country. You need to start building time machines. We have to help people fall in love with the future. In my own work, I'm doing a project called Field Recordings from the Future, working with an amazing ambient electronic music artist called Mr. Kit. Field Recordings from the Future, you can find it on Bandcamp. And we've created 8 pieces of music where I go to visit places that already sound like the future needs to sound like. The Utrecht bicycle rush hour, regenerative farms, landscapes rewilded by beavers. We build music around it. We make videos around it. And next year, we're going to be going on tour with this amazing immersive light show where we will project that all around people and pick people up in 2025, take them to 2030. Look out for it. It'll be happening somewhere around the country. We're also doing a comic book about how we built a time machine and went to the future, because I think if Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk had grown up reading comic books about beaver rewilding and underground mushroom farms rather than the ones they did grow up, the world might look really rather different. And I think that's all I was going to say. And I'd love to hear your questions, because that's always the most interesting bit. Thank you for time traveling with me today. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Yes, I think we have a few minutes for questions. Also, as I said before, I'm going to be over signing books at 11. If you've got any questions, do come and see me then, or I'll be around here for a few days. Which one? Oh, it's called Field Recordings from the Future. If you go on Bandcamp, I think it lets you listen to it 5 times, and then it goes, you need to buy it now. But there's also a beautiful, beautiful double vinyl version of it as well, which is the most exciting thing of my entire life. And you can buy that there as well. So, yes. Any questions?
I was just thinking of the tradition of futurology and what I think that you're sinking in with, which you might know all about, but do you know about the two utopian fictions that were written in argument with each other that profoundly affected the socialist movement 100 years ago?
Do you mean the News from Nowhere?
By Morris and Edward Bellamy's Looking Backwards, which was written first, and Morris wrote News from Nowhere very angrily in response, because one was a technological utopian future set in New York by Bellamy, and Morris was furious and wrote an arts and crafts with even electric boats going along the Thames future set in London.
Beautiful, thank you.
And that actually formed massive arguments within the socialist movement of the 1920s about what future they wanted to imagine was from those two time travel fictions, which were built on the base of stuff like H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. Yeah. And I'm just like, it seems like you're riffing on that, but in a fantastically contemporary way. And I just wondered if you were aware.
Thank you. Yeah. The lovely thing about H.G. Wells' The Time Machine book is that before he wrote that book, the idea that you might intentionally choose to travel backwards or forwards in time to specific places had never occurred to anybody. And what's really beautiful about it was, as soon as he wrote that book, everyone was like, yeah, cool, great. And so it's like, and also that anything can be a time machine. Like if I stand up in front of 1,000 people and say, I've bought my time machine, no one ever says, ah, now, Rob, come on. Explain to me the quantum mechanics of exactly how that teapot is going to break the space-time continuum barrier. People say, cool, where are we going? And so one of the things that I have in the work that I do is that people send me photographs of time machines that they've built. There are some very strange people out there. But it's this beautiful thing. And yeah, I have to confess, I've not read either of those books, but I very much know about their reputation. What's really interesting now is to see that there are people, that there is a sort of a... actually, a lot of it coming from that kind of Afrofuturist tradition, but there's also some of you might have read Kim Stanley Robinson's book, A Ministry for the Future, which was a really brave attempt in a novel to set out how we got from here to there. And Manda Scott, who some of you may know, does the Accidental Gods podcast. She talks about what she calls thrutopian storytelling, which is the idea that we don't need any more dystopias. For God's sake, we are awash with dystopias. You turn on Netflix, we are either wiped out by zombies or viruses or aliens or whatever it is. We have far too many dystopias. Even utopias aren't that useful because they're often so far away. But actually what we need are the stories that start now. Amanda's written an amazing book called Any Human Power, which is one of those books about what started now, how it built. There's a book that I'm reading at the moment called... Everything for Everyone, which is a really beautiful conceit that is written in 2072 after the revolution in America, and it's people's oral histories about what happened. It's really, really, really interesting, and there's more and more people kind of writing things like that. So I feel like that utopian storytelling has been an important thing in most movements. We haven't had anywhere near enough of it, I think, in the movements that we have now, that we have to give people things to run towards rather than just things to run screaming in the opposite direction from, I think.
What was Amanda saying?
Amanda, without an A on the front, Manda Scott. It's called Any Human Power. She does a podcast called Accidental Gods.
Sorry, just to interrupt. We're going to overrun by 5 minutes, if that's okay with everyone. So if you need to go off, that's fine, but we're going to run over just 5 minutes because we started a bit late. We've got a question here, and then, Rob, if you want to carry on choosing after this person here. So I'll just take this one here first.
Yes.
Thank you, Rob. Is there anything like a future atlas or a future Eventbrite where we can go and visit these places. Because I live on the canals, and many of the things you described, it's already a bit like that with water. So is there somewhere we can go to go touring to experience
that's
the future?
That's a very,
already?
Very lovely idea. There's so Sun Ra made a film in 1972 called A Space Is the Place, which is the most bonkers way to spend an hour and a half, which is about him coming to Earth to save humanity and then realizing they didn't want to be saved, so he left again. But with lots of amazing, the best jazz music you've ever heard as part of it. But in that, he has a thing which is called the Outer Space Employment Agency, where people can come and apply for jobs on different planets, which is just beautiful. I don't know of anything like that. I think we need something like that. It's what I try and do. Like, so in the book that I've in How to Fall in Love with the Future, I try to pull it together as many of those different things as I can. Walida Imarisha, who I write about in the book, she did a thing in America that was called the People's Encyclopedia of 2070, where she chose things that, so she would say, like, 2070, prisons abolished in the United States. And then they would work backwards and tell the stories about how we actually got there. So those kind of things exist. I think people do bits of that in certain places. And I think we can use things like that to represent the work we're already doing. When I was a permaculture teacher, I used to do an activity that was called Future Tour Guides, where after I taught everybody about urban gardening, rainwater harvesting, using vertical spaces, we would go out into a nearby housing estate and I would say, it's now 2030. This is now the most amazing permaculture estate in the world. People come from all over to come and see it. You're the tour guides. Take us round and show it to us. So we'd go walking around a very ordinary housing estate with lawns and cars, and they'd go, look here, there's this amazing raised beds here and the hops growing up here, and just to try and kind of overlay that on top. But it's a beautiful idea. We need to do more of that. Thank you. Yes, that's you.
Thank you so much. Bloody marvellous talk. I almost thought I could go left
now. No, Greenbelt hasn't peaked yet.
But I'm really struck by many things.
Just say, can everybody hear the question? No. Can you pass there? Thank you. Because I sense this is going to be a good one. No pressure.
Thank you. Bloody marvellous, thank you. I was really struck by what you said about your special cynicism coating.
Yeah.
Anti-cynicism coating. Could you just unpack your thoughts about that a bit more? I need some of that.
Well, it's a... So you might have seen, like, if you see any pictures of around this field recordings from the future, myself and Mr. Kit, who is the guy who makes the music, we always have these... So when I got asked to do the thing, the Extinction Rebellion talk, just after I'd seen this T-shirt, and I thought, okay, I'm going to give this talk as if I've just come back from 2030. I thought, either this is going to be amazing or this is career suicide. I have really no way of telling which way this is going to go. And so I went to the corner shop and bought a hazmat suit. And then I bought like a child's sort of pretend space bubble helmet thing. And then I turned up in this. I've been to the future. We won on a placard. That was my placard that I took to the Extinction Rebellion thing. And so then we've kind of built this whole narrative around what these things are for. And if you see when we do the field recordings from the future shows next year, you'll see in the videos, sometimes one of us is wearing a helmet. Sometimes both of us are. There's never any narrative that explains under what circumstances just one of us needs to wear a helmet, the other one doesn't. But the idea with the suits is that by 2030, because this thing about utopias and dystopias, we get so hung up on this. When I do workshops with storytellers, they're like, yes, but you know, dystopias are so much easier to write than utopias. And utopias, you know, they're a bit hard to generate dramatic tension in a utopia. I'm like, you're missing the point completely. We're not going 1,000 years into the future, into sort of eco world where everybody loves each other and we all live off seaweed. It's like, actually, we're going forwards 5 years, maybe 10 years, because that's what we need to connect with that world. Because if we don't create that, and it means that London, Birmingham, Leeds will still look like London, Birmingham, Leeds. We're not going to have knocked them down and rebuilt them all as passive houses, surround with gardens on the roof, but we're adapting and working around. The point is, there's a bit in the book where I say it's work in progress, but damn, it's amazing work in progress. And that's what we want to take people to. So the idea is that if you were to land into that future where people can see the insects coming back, they can see young people's mental health improving, they can see those toxic extremes in wealth really starting to narrow and become much more manageable. What would that feel like? What would that taste like? What would that smell like? And that the last thing they would need is some kind of colonial time traveler, a bit like H.G. Wells. You know, there was still in H.G. Wells, there was still a little bit of that colonial sort of white man in plus fours striding in and going, oh, look at you strange people. What are you doing exactly? And so that's not how we time travel. So the idea with the anti-cynicism coating is that it keeps any residual despair and despondency we might have been carrying with us from 2025. It keeps it inside the suit. That means we can just be observers and document what's happening. So we bring back from that future photographs. If we'd have had a screen here, I would have showed you all sorts of amazing photographs and things from 2030, but you'll have to come and see me do that somewhere else for that. Your imaginations were much, much better, I think. But, you know, so we bring things back from there. But that's the idea, is to that we don't contaminate what's happening there with that sort of, oh, yeah, right, like this is going to happen, because it is.
I think we've got time for one more question.
One more question.
Sorry.
Oh, someone waving at the back there in the most beautiful shade of pink, which I think that's...
Do you want to shout?
Go on.
Yeah, it's a simple question, because I love the picture you're painting, but what is the source of your hope?
What is the source of my hope? Beautiful. Thank you. There's a film that some of you might have seen that came out a few years ago called 2040, made by an Australian guy, where he tried to paint a picture of the future he wanted his daughter to grow up in. And some of it was great. He used CGI to sort of create what this future would be like. Some of it was great, some of it a bit questionable. But when he was describing that film, he called it an experiment in evidence-based dreaming. So for me, that's kind of what I'm trying to do. So in the book, when I tell the story about the visit that we made to the future, it's all referenced to, you can go and see this. You can go and see this. You can go and see this. And actually tying into the question about the tour that somebody that was just asked there, I did a book launch in Stroud, I think, for the book. And there was a guy, the book had only been out a couple of weeks. The guy, he must have got an early copy somehow. This guy said, I read your book and I designed my whole summer holiday to visit all the places in the book. So he went to Utrecht. If you sit in the center of Utrecht at 8 a.m. in the morning on a weekday, 40,000 bicycles will cycle past you and trams, and that's it. And it just blows your mind. It's like, and then he went to the Vauban in Freiburg, the car-free neighborhood. 3,000 people live there without any cars. Then he went to Marseille to visit Le Pressage, which is a restaurant on the edge of Marseille that cooks just using the heat from the sun with two big parabolic dishes out the back that focus the sun's rays onto the back of the cooker, and it gets incredibly hot. Beautiful ecological restaurant. He went to Moinsartou, a half an hour away from Nice, where they grow 80% of the school meals, and they've created all the social change that I talked about before. So you can do that. All of those things already exist. That's what gives me hope. This is not like, it's like if you decided you wanted to become a millionaire in 5 years' time, right? You at least need to go and buy a lottery ticket or sort of start trying to sort of find rich people to sort of inveigle your way. You don't just imagine a dragon's going to fly past and drop gold onto your garden. You know, so for me, the point is everything that we need to know. There's a chapter in the book that says we need to stop using the word impossible and replace it with the word not yet. Because we live in a time where all the things we're told are impossible, like you can't have a world without economic growth, like et cetera, where we can't decarbonize rapidly. All that stuff we know we have to do, and all the stuff that we're told we have to do, like economic growth, endless economic growth on a finite planet, that we know are actually impossible. So we need to reframe that. So for me, what gives me hope is that I go to those places. I see them. I know they can work. The cities of the future need to have the cycling infrastructure of Rotterdam, the super blocks of Barcelona, the food belt of Liège, etc., etc., etc. We're not waiting. We have government spending millions and millions of pounds on innovation. We don't need to spend more money on innovation. The innovation that we need, the innovation that we're lacking, is the cultivation of longing at scale. As the novelist Don DeLillo said, longing on a large scale is what makes history. And we should never forget that.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.